From NPR News, this is a special report. I'm Leanne Hansen. President Bush is expected to make a statement very shortly from the Roosevelt Room in the White House. It is expected that he will be making a statement about the death of Chief Justice William Rehnquist. He died last night at the age of 80. While we are awaiting for the president in the Roosevelt Room, NPR's Ron Elving is with me. Ron, what do you expect the president to say?
We just got the news, of course, about Chief Justice Rehnquist last night, so the president is just now having a chance to really make his first full statement. I think he will acknowledge the Chief Justice's contribution to changing the nature of the Supreme Court, to his pivotal role in moving the court in a more conservative direction, particularly over the 19 years that he was the Chief Justice. I think he'll talk about the legacy that Rehnquist leaves and how difficult it will be for someone to fill those shoes. And in other words, he will begin the process of introducing his own nominee to do so. Not that that person is necessarily chosen at this point, but certainly the president has been thinking about it for a number of weeks and months as Mr. Rehnquist's health has deteriorated.
Do you expect him at all to mention John Roberts, his nominee for the other seat, the seat that will be vacated by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor?
He may or he may not. He, of course, wants Mr. Roberts to be confirmed. There were going to be hearings this coming week. We may or may not see them. They may be postponed because of the Rehnquist death. He may mention him because he certainly wants to endorse that nomination one more time. He may, on the other hand, forbear for the reason that he does not want to make it sound as though the Roberts nomination is the nomination to fulfill the Chief Justice's job. That may go to someone else, and Roberts has actually been appointed to be the Supreme Court Justice in place of Sandra Day O'Connor, who was an Associate Justice. So for the moment, that's the plan.
The President is at the Roosevelt Room, and we join him in progress.
Lauren, I send our respect and deepest sympathy to this good man's children, Jim, Janet, and Nancy. We send our respect to all the members of the Rehnquist family. William H. Rehnquist was born and raised in Wisconsin. He was the grandson of Swedish immigrants. Like so many of his generation, he served in the Army during World War II. He went on to college with the help of the GI Bill. He studied law at Stanford University. He graduated first in his class. That included his future colleague, Sandra Day O'Connor. Judge Rehnquist and his late wife, Nan, raised their family in Phoenix, where he built a career as one of Arizona's leading attorneys. He went on to even greater distinction in public service as an Assistant U.S. Attorney General, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, and for the past 19 years, Chief Justice of the United States. He was extremely well respected for his powerful intellect. He was respected for his deep commitment to the rule of law and his profound devotion to duty. He provided superb leadership for the federal court system, improving the delivery of justice for the American people and earning the admiration of his colleagues throughout the judiciary. Even during a period of illness, Chief Justice Rehnquist stayed on the job to complete the work of his final Supreme Court term. I was honored and I was deeply touched when he came to the Capitol for the swearing-in last January. He was a man of character and dedication. His departure represents a great loss for the court and for our country. There are now two vacancies on the Supreme Court, and it will serve the best interests of the nation to fill those vacancies promptly. I will choose in a timely manner a highly qualified nominee to succeed Chief Justice Rehnquist. As we look to the future of the Supreme Court, citizens of this nation can also look with pride and appreciation on the career of our late Chief Justice. More than half a century has passed since William H. Rehnquist first came to the Supreme Court as a young law clerk. All of his years, William Rehnquist revered the Constitution and laws of the United States. He led the judicial branch of government with tremendous wisdom and skill. He honored America with a lifetime of service, and America will honor his memory. May God bless the Rehnquist family. Thank you all very much.
You've been listening to President Bush speaking at the Roosevelt Room at the White House, remembering Chief Justice William Rehnquist, who died last night. From NPR News, this has been a special report. I'm Leanne Hansen. From NPR News in Washington, this is Weekend Edition. I'm Leanne Hansen. I'm joined in the studio by NPR's Ron Elving. We have been watching the president as he appeared in the Roosevelt Room of the White House to remember Chief Justice William Rehnquist, who died last night at the age of 80. Ron, I'd like to ask you, first of all, what impressed you about the president's remarks. One thing that stuck with me is that he said that the Chief Justice was working up until days before his health began to deteriorate, that he stayed on the job. What struck you?
I think the president is reverential about the service that this man has given to the country, not just as Chief Justice or as a justice of the Supreme Court, which goes back 33 years, but he used the figure back half a century when he first worked as a law clerk, and before that, in the 1940s, as a member of the World War II generation, served in the Army in North Africa. He also mentioned his family, his children, his three children, his wife, who died a little over a decade ago, who had been a very close companion and one of his very most important people in his life, a close confidant of his. And he also mentioned his heritage as being the grandson of Swedish immigrants and someone who grew up in Wisconsin, touching the Midwestern element in Rehnquist's makeup and composition. Also talked about his time at Stanford Law School, and of course he is a kind of legend with respect to the Stanford Law School and that class that also produced Sandra Day O'Connor. He was a phenomenon at that time, and someone who went very quickly through the law school and on to clerk for Robert Jackson on the Supreme Court. The president touched all of the high points, I guess you'd have to say, of the Rehnquist resume, and also, I think, more subtly implying that he achieved what he set out to achieve as Richard Nixon's appointment to the court and then as Ronald Reagan's appointment to be chief, which was the new direction, the new conservative direction of the court in the later part of the 20th century.
He also said, the president said, that the death of Chief Justice Rehnquist was a great loss for the court. I mean, obviously losing the man is a great loss, but what does it mean for the court?
William Rehnquist, I think, would properly be seen as an institutionalist on the court. He believed in the role of the government, although he was highly conservative. He also believes that the federal government, the state, has a central role to play in certain respects, and certainly in terms of the authority that it has over other elements of government, and in terms of how it interprets the law. He also was someone who believed that the Supreme Court itself was an important organic part of the government, and he was highly concerned about whether or not it was being viewed in the best possible light for the role that it was supposed to play, for the conflicts it was supposed to deal with and not deal with, that his view of what the court's proper function should be as widely shared as possible, and he worked very hard at that.
He did make a point of mentioning that there are two seats vacant on the Supreme Court, and he talked about finding a nominee for Chief Justice Rehnquist's seat in a timely fashion, promptly. But this week, hearings were about to start before the Judiciary Committee towards the nomination of John Roberts for the seat that is being vacated by Sandra Day O'Connor. Now, what do you know about, first of all, whether those hearings are going to take place this week, and perhaps what the death of Mr. Rehnquist will mean to that process?
The absence of William Rehnquist from the Supreme Court was always going to be part of the confirmation of John Roberts. And I at this point, think that the confirmation of John Roberts is going ahead apace and will probably be delayed in terms of the hearings for a matter of a couple of days or perhaps a week. There's going to be a funeral, of course, and it would not be possible to continue the hearings on the day of the funeral. So it would probably seem logistically indicated that they would just push them off for a full week. Some of the senators already wanted to do this even before because of the hurricane disaster and all the distraction, of course, that is for the government at all levels. So there was some possibility that they were going to delay the hearings anyway. Now I think it's clearly indicated by the funeral. When they do return and have the confirmation hearings, the Rehnquist issue will be much more front and center. But it was always part of everyone's thinking that this was going to be one of two vacancies in a fairly short period of time, perhaps not absolutely coincident, but within a short period of time because of the deterioration of the Chief Justice's health. He's been treated for thyroid cancer since last winter. And in the spring, of course, as you recall, there were a flurry of rumors. Everyone expected him to step down in June, about the time that Sandra Day O'Connor did, to make it a brace of appointments that the president could make at once. And it would be an interesting historical note because the last time that two vacancies occurred at the same time was in 1971, and one of them was filled by William Rehnquist. So many people thought he would do that, but he decided he wanted to go as far and as long as he could. And as the president said today, he worked right up until the very last week.
We do want to talk about Hurricane Katrina because that is a major story, and there have been developments over the weekend and overnight. But before I do, we leave the question of Chief Justice William Rehnquist. Although the president said, well, he doesn't have a nominee, he wasn't going to come out with a name, do you think he has someone, or the idea of what kind of jurist he would like to put on the court to replace the Chief Justice?
Yes, I think yes on both counts. I think he has a name in mind. I think he may have four or five alternative or optional names in mind. And certainly I think he has a notion of what kind of justice he wants. He wants to see someone who, like John Roberts, would be seen as a strict constructionist. That means someone who views the Constitution as a document that should be interpreted only within a strong discipline, that it should not be the basis for individual jurists to use their imagination about what the framers of the Constitution might do in 2000 or 2005 or 1990, but looked to more in terms of its original intent and interpreted very conservatively. He will certainly want that kind of a justice, and he has a great number to choose among. One of the people, of course, that he is interested in and personally fond of is Alberto Gonzalez, who was his attorney back in Texas. He appointed him to the Texas State Supreme Court. He brought him here to Washington to be his attorney in the White House and then made him the Attorney General of the United States, the first Hispanic so named. So this is someone he's clearly interested in, but there are a number of other people that would be more pleasing to some elements of the president's base. Some of the conservatives who are seen as being more clearly opposed, for example, to Roe versus Wade, the 1973 decision that legalized abortion nationally. Some of those people might be more popular with some social conservatives who aren't so certain how Alberto Gonzalez might rule on that case.
Let's talk a little bit about Hurricane Katrina. The destruction has just been devastating and shocking this past week, and the dimensions of this disaster are still pretty ill-defined, but there's no mistake that there's been incalculable human suffering here, and fingers are being pointed in all directions to place blame for the slow response to the storm. How do you see the potential for this to play out politically?
Well, last week, Scott McClellan, the president's spokesperson, said this was no time to point fingers. And that's one of those statements that is made sometimes in Washington, which generally means that fingers are about to be pointed. Of course, this is inevitable, and it's going to happen very quickly in this case because emotions are running so high. Congress returns on Tuesday. The Senate Governmental Affairs Committee under Chairman Susan Collins of Maine is going to hold hearings. Ranking Member Joe Lieberman, the Democrat on that committee, is eager to hold hearings as well. So I think we'll see hearings on the Senate side and then on the House side as well. And there will be a great deal of frustration over the pace of the relief, which clearly everyone acknowledges now was 2-3 days behind the rate that people would have expected. However, who was most responsible for that? That's a question that's going to be asked in all quarters. And we have begun to see some pushback from some Republicans who don't like the blame that's being focused on the White House, saying, what about the state government? What particularly about the state government in Louisiana? Did they do everything they should have done? Did they request aid in the formal fashion they should have in a timely enough manner? And polls that have already come out indicate that people think the state and local governments were ill-prepared, even in a higher proportion, 75% telling pollsters that it was the state and the local governments that should have been better prepared than, say, the federal. Two-thirds of the people telling the pollsters that the federal government was not adequately prepared. So there is some room for political argument here, and wherever there is such room in a time of great suffering, there will be severe blame and finger-pointing politics.
Won't there also be discussions of actions that might have been taken even years ago? Environmental concerns, for example, cutbacks in fundings for the levees.
There was a remarkable series of stories in the 1992 series from the Times-Picayune newspaper in New Orleans. And subsequently, Danny Zwerdling of NPR did a series of stories regarding this particular issue. Money for the levees in New Orleans was severely restricted in the years since 9/11. And with the rise of the Department of Homeland Security, the focus on terrorism as their first concern. And there has been a great deal of environmental deterioration in that area of the Gulf Coast, particularly in Louisiana, that could have contributed to this. Government decisions that were made to put money in other priorities may well have contributed to the nature of this disaster, which has been foreseen for years and predicted for years by scientists, academics, engineers, and ordinary New Orleans citizens who know they live below the sea level.
Of course, gas prices are also of concern now for many Americans.
A huge vulnerability for all politicians is the availability of fuel, gasoline, heating oil, and the price that people have to pay for it. In the long run, that's going to affect many more Americans than have been thus far affected by the Gulf Coast tragedy.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the conflict continues in Iraq.
Something that's been very much on the country's mind throughout the month of August and only supplanted in the last week by this hurricane.
NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Leanne.